Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest. And I know from a previous podcast with Marshal Eddie Conway, this is going to be a really important one. And the reason I'm having him back and want to talk about it, Eddie spent almost 45 years in a prison in Baltimore. He was framed. I'm going to use that word very specifically. He was framed in a shooting of policeman, and it very clearly came out that the founding members of the Black Panther Party that he was in, that a couple of them were working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Baltimore Police Department, and those two agencies were cooperating in trying to destroy this Black Panther unit, and in particular to destroy Eddie Conway, who was a three-year veteran in the American military that people were supposed to honor. And then he was working in the post office. And in fact, his supervisor in the post office testified that he was working in the post office at the time of that murder. Nonetheless, it took the courts almost 45 years to free him. So among other things, and he's been working at the Real News Network, which I think is fantastic in Baltimore. But of course, they do national reporting. And I've been interviewed by him as well as interviewing him. But I think they do great work covering not just Baltimore, but of course, the nation. That's realnews.com. Check it out. And so, but the reason I wanted to talk to Eddie is he did a program on the exploitation of prison labor. And, you know, if you want to talk about a quality of life in America and our democracy, you got to start with the fact that we have the biggest prison system in the world. And it is racially biased, people call it, particularly black people, to get control them. So, Eddie, why don't you talk about the people you interviewed, some people doing really great work on trying to get people. And I know one of the things you did in prison, in addition, was a model prisoner. By their standards, even by the authorities, he organized the prison library. He tried to organize a prison union while he was in there on a life sentence. So tell us about this. We've discussed your past with the Panthers, but tell us about what prison labor and the role it plays in the American economy.
Well, I think it's important to even take a step back in history. I was thinking about this conversation we was going to have, and I went all the way back to the founding fathers, and I realized that the importation of slavery, the capture and putting on reservations indigenous populations, I realized that America that we see today is founded on prison labor. Some of it was called slavery. Some of it was called captives or whatever it was called. But it was the use of other people's labor for free for certain elements of society, the elite. And they passed the laws. They paid the patrols. They did the work. They did exactly what happens today in prisons. They extract labor from people that can't protect yourself, that can't get out of it. And I went and I looked at it, and I realized that after the Civil War, there was an explosion of prisons across the South and even throughout the rest of the country because of Emancipation Proclamation and a massive amount of people were put into prisons for being vagrants, for whatever reason, and forced to work, back to work on plantations, in factories, so on. And all throughout American history, what we find is the use of prison labor, whether it was the missions in L.A. with the indigenous populations, fighting the fires, or building or working on the farms and so on, or whether it was even after the Civil War. And I thought this was interesting, that the importation of the Chinese, who obviously came for a better life, worked here and build those the transcontinental railroads, etc., and then had to sleep every night in holes in the ground to hide to protect yourself from the fear of being killed or lynched or raped or attacked and so on. And I realized that prison is the foundation. Prisoners is the foundation of the wealth of today's society. And so I looked even further and I realized, well, colonialization is just an extension of the empire's prison system. And so prison and prisoners play a key role in what we're looking at today in terms of the wealth that's now allowing people to take joyrides in the space. I understand it's a new move to colonize other planets and other bodies and so on. But that wealth comes from the labor, free labor of prisoners. And that's not to take anything away from the working class and the workers, because they are also exploited and their surplus labor is taken and their wealth is taken also. But prisoners is the foundation of this. So let me stop just there for a minute.
Well, why stop? I think this is a critical observation. And by the way, there's not a wall between the so-called free laborers and prisoners, because one way you kept working people in check was the fear of being jailed, and including for going on strike. The private corporations very often had their own police departments working with official police departments, the Pinkertons and others, and the very idea of even being able to be in a union and organize for white people. Your description of what happened to Chinese workers is, I mean, it's abysmal. We never talk about it. You couldn't even get citizenship if you're one of those workers. You couldn't marry. You couldn't have your wife come here until World War II, that finally got lifted, because it was an embarrassment. China was our ally up until then. If you were a Chinese American worker, you were lesser. Far less a human being, but even white workers were subject to this kind of imprisonment, not called slavery, but they would be picked up on one charge or another, disturbing the peace or violating property, and also framed. After all, we had the Sacco and Vanzetti case, in many cases of workers being framed. But I want to pick up on your main point about the 13th Amendment, and it's really interesting, the language of the 13th Amendment in your program on the Real News Network, which I recommend people listen to Eddie Conway's show, Shaking the Bars. I got that right?
Rattling the Bars.
Yes. Conducted by a guy who spent almost 45 years behind bars. But I want to read this 13th Amendment, because you interviewed two people in California who are trying to organize, you know, around this issue of the exploitation of prison labor. And as I say, we got the biggest prison population going in the world. I would blame, talk about human rights everywhere else, but not here. Let's read the 13th Amendment passed back in 1865, along with the 14th Amendment freeing, ending slavery. But what it said was very clear. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, okay, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, comma, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, comma, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So there was an escape clause here, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. Now, in your case, they would say, well, you were duly convicted. And then the court said, no, you were not, because your rights were fundamentally stopped. And by the way, I point out, one thing really shocked me. We're supposed to have a lawyer of our choice, and you wanted Kunstler and forgetting who else. Who was the other lawyer you wanted at first who was involved with the civil rights movement?
Well, actually, it was Kunstler. Kunstler had sent some. They initially tried to get Charles Gurry.
Yeah, right.
But Kunstler was on the East Coast, yes.
Yeah, and Kunstler and Gurry were two great lawyers who did defend some Black Panthers. You were denied the right to have them. They were volunteering pro bono to defend you, and that was taken away from you. They gave you a lawyer that didn't even meet with you,
yeah,
and then you refused to cooperate, and that was so-called fair trial. So you accept as a punishment for crime where the party shall have been duly convicted. You were never duly convicted. And finally, after almost 45 years in prison, the court said, no, he wasn't duly convicted. So the Constitution was violated on both counts. But the interesting thing is this escape clause that, okay, if we can duly convict these people, we can throw them in jail, and then they don't have any rights. So let's focus on that. We've got a lot of attention to Black Lives Matter, all sorts of struggles now about freedom of the individual, but that prison population remains a grotesque indictment of the United States. So let's talk about the exploitation and these people you interviewed. As I say, people should go to the Real News Network. I'm not trying to be competitive here. I have great respect for it, and should go there and watch your interview and show. And I'm going to start putting your show up on my own share post. But, tell us about this issue and why we should be concerned.
Yeah, and I was impressed. I interviewed Geronimo and John, and they both work for All of Us or None. And they were in the process, they are in the process of organizing a legal challenge to that 13th Amendment and to that exception clause. And they have a challenge that's in the California State House now. But they had been successful in three other states already to remove that clause from the state constitution, because even though that's a federal constitution statute, each state has to codify it. And so they are challenging the states, because what happens, and I'm going to take another step back for a minute just to talk about it, because I didn't talk about it when I was talking to them, but you mentioned it. And it's true. I organized myself and comrades within the prison system in the state of Maryland, a prison labor union. And the union that Dr. King was assassinated for supporting accepted us as a prison labor unit. And we signed up the population. We did all the due diligence. We did everything that we needed to do. And of course, they shut us down and locked us up. But back in 72, it was understood then that if you had a labor union, then you could demand minimum wage and you could do also legal organized strikes. And it was something that the prison industrial complex was scared entirely of. Well, leap forward like 40 years later or so, as it is now, almost 50 years later, there are actually efforts now on the ground, and I like the efforts that all of us or none are doing, because that's the key. If you take the money away from exploitation, at that time in 72, I was making 9 cents an hour. Now I think it's more. You can make like 41 cents an hour now. And so in prison, that sounds like a lot of money, but if you need a bar of soap, as you well know, that's the end of that money right there, so the issue is around the money. And if you take the money from the prison industrial complex, the prison industrial complex will dry up, because it's resisting the working class people. It's resisting people outside, because it's so easy to exploit the labor of prisoners. And what a lot of people don't know, we have, or not we, but prisoners have no actual protection against harm done, whatever a position they make you work in, or whether you work around chemicals, or whether you work in a hazardous industry, or you can work somewhere in the wood shop and get your hand cut off. They will give you a set amount of money for that hand, but you have no federal protections. Prisoners have no rights to protect their body from whatever the guards and the administration decide to do to them or with them. And that makes exploitation even more egregious. And so then you have the right to not work. And as a result of exercising that right, you are punished by putting in solitary confinement and in isolation and to lose whatever good time privileges you have, even though you haven't been bad, or lose whatever good time days you were going to earn because you wasn't working. So you end up doing a longer sentence. So there's this big stick that's sitting out there all the time. You work or you suffer. And if you work, you still suffer. So attacking that clause in each state, like I say, it's passed already in several states, and you can look at the Real News Network and see the states and see it. But All of Us or None is like spread throughout 16 states, I believe. There's 30 chapters. And this is the way to go. This is where the rubber meets the road in terms of changing the prison industrial complex, to take away that exploited labor and take away that excess profit. And incidentally, it's states. It's not just private prisons, but it's states that's making that money. It's states that's selling those licenses. It's states that's selling that furniture. It's states that's making chocolate, or states that's even organizing airline tickets. They are making states that's making money from the phone systems, from the food, multinational food corporations and so on, even selling the toilet paper. So you got to take that money away from them. And this 13th Amendment exclusion clause is the way to do it.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
You know, people are unaware, really. They use this phrase, the prison industrial complex. And then people say, well, what does that really mean? Just take a ride up. I mean, I'm doing this from California, Los Angeles. You go up Highway 99 or in California, and you will be aware of a prison industrial complex that is in almost every major rural area, and it's sustaining false consciousness of people who live there. It's the basis of their economy. This prison, the local state prison, some federal prisons, and aside from the prison labor, which is real enough, you know, the fact is this is a job opportunity that sustains. It's the main job opportunity in many of these communities because other jobs have dried up. And we look the other way. That's what I want to get at. We're talking to Eddie Conway, who spent almost 45 years in prison. By the way, it's not ancient history to him. He only got out, 7 years ago, right?
Yeah.
7 years ago. Come on, this is not ancient history. And when I interviewed him, I think he had only been out 3-4 years. I just want to read from the Wikipedia description. And you know, Wikipedia is very contested, so people, it's all footnoted. I happen to like Wikipedia a lot for that reason. I'm going to quote this. During his imprisonment, Conway earned 3 college degrees, started a literacy program, and was an exemplary prisoner during the entire time. Conway maintained his innocence. Conway supporters have called him one of the country's longest held political prisoners. When I pointed out before, the FBI and the Baltimore police collaborated in setting him up and convicting him. While incarcerated, Conway tried to organize prison unions and organize a prison library. You know, I'm going to ask you a question that my wife, Narda Zucchino, who you know, and she did some work with the Real News, he's been on death row in California, and a lot of people working to try to get him. You know, he's now going through a examination innocence project to see ordered by our governor. it's a brave thing he did, Gavin Newsom. But the fact of the matter is, I'm talking to you like this is all normal and stuff. I can't, you know, I've only spent a few days in different countries in jail, and it was scary enough, whether it was Mexico, Algeria, or the United States. But, you know, you manage, and I've seen this with Kevin Cooper, because I went into Death Row to interview him at one point, spent some hours there, and we talk on the phone, and I've done podcasts with him. I am amazed, and I've met you, I'm amazed how whole you are, how you manage to somehow go through for over 44 years, almost 45 years, and you're concerned about other prisoners now. You're concerned about justice. You're concerned about improving the system. How the hell did you survive this thing? And particularly given that all the evidence is clear that you were innocent. How did you manage to get through this?
Well, I want to go back, but I'll answer that first.
You take it any which way you want. You certainly earn the right to control the podcast. Besides, you're great. Great on video. You're great on video. You're great on radio. You're a great journalist. And so I'm not. I'm going to shut up from now. And we a good 10 minutes or so. Take it wherever you want, Eddie. Really.
Okay, let me look. I will address that. But let me look back a minute, because you said something that was really important that I tried to get the audiences to understand. When you go through rural Maryland, Hagerstown, Cumberland, the Eastern Shore, these are places that are 100, 200, in some cases 300 miles away from urban centers. What you'll find is prison complexes all over the place. And as you pointed out, employment for the community, for the teachers, for the plumbers, the suppliers of toilet paper, the male and female population is employed as guards, etc. What happens is, and I think this is an important thing, is you take a urban population that's primarily young and black and male, and you put them in a rural area in a close-knit white population that's primarily white and mostly male in terms of the guard force, and with a different set of cultural values and a different set of ideas, and it's them or us. And this, so there's two. One is like, we're correctional officers. We are here to make you do right. You are criminals and the criminal element, and we're going to keep you controlled, and we're going to keep society safe from you. And there's a clash in those rural prisons. There's a clash of culture. There's a clash of ideas. There's a clash of ethnicities. And there's a clash of testosterone. And in some cases, women also. Then you have the frustration of prisoners being constantly beaten, constantly gassed, constantly abused, being subdued in all kinds of ways, being threatened constantly. And when those prisoners fight back, they lose, they go on lockup, they do hard time, they get battered up. When they come home to the urban centers, they're angry, they're frustrated, they're hostile, and the least little thing sets them off. And that's where that violence that we see in the urban centers is manufactured in those rural prisons. That violence that we see is transferred hostility, transferred aggression, is transferred anger, is frustration. The prisoner comes home saying like, yeah, I broke the law. I did the time. I got the sentence. But y'all let them abuse me up there. Y'all let them do all kinds of things to me. And so I have no respect for you either. I have no respect for anything, because now I have been victimized above and beyond what I think was the proper and right thing to do in terms of punishing me. And that's where you get that violence at. And it's important to understand that, because people look at that violence and say, why are they killing each other? Why is this going on? Well, go to Cumberland, go to Eastern Shore, go to Hagerstown, and you'll see it. And you'll see where it comes from. And I've been to all those places, so what I say is direct experience. I've seen this. But it's important for people to understand that. So they're not only making livings off of that, but they're also creating violent elements that they're sending back to the urban centers. And that's both white and black, but mainly black. Now, in terms of how to survive in prison, I went in prison knowing that I was going to get out and knowing that this was a egregious wrong and that I needed to fight, and I needed to fight every day. And every day I woke up fighting, but I also woke up trying to figure out whether or not I could climb over the wall. I also woke up trying to figure out, because Kunsa had came down and he was still supportive of me, and his team was supportive of me. So I was constantly trying to figure out if there's a legal angle, and we just did everything. But every day you spend doing something positive and you keep up with what's going on, and you'll survive that. Unfortunately, most prisoners put their life on hold and plan on making it up when they get out. But that's a mistake, because you can't make it up. The time is gone. So you have to use that time that you have to live the best quality of life you can and to do everything you can to change the conditions that you find yourself in disagreement with. Okay?
Yeah, but I want you to push that further, because first of all, we don't give enough credit to the few attorneys like William Kunstler who really give a damn, who really stay with it. And this is happening in the Kevin Cooper case. There's a good number of people, lawyers. There's actually even a corporate lawyer, Norm Heil, who has stayed with it, I think, 13 years. And, you know, try to get, now you got a Governor Newsom who's going to maybe be recalled, unfortunately, because he did a very brave thing in ordering a new DNA testing for Kevin Cooper. But mostly, we imprison people, and yes, primarily of color and poorer people, and then we want to throw away the key. And there isn't any consciousness of the very... Here I am talking to a guy who was in this prison system for over 44 years. I couldn't handle it for 44 days. Clearly, while you were in prison and out, you made a great contribution, but mostly these are forgotten people. And when I looked around at the people waiting to visit people in San Quentin, when I went in there, and my wife's gone in there, you know, she was the associate editor of the LA Times. It's been quite an education for her going in there 44 times so far. You know, you're talking about ordinary people who love the person in jail, whatever reason. They are ordinary families. They're mostly poorer. They're many people of color. But the fact is, these are wives, sons, children, brothers, everything, and they're forgotten. And the reason, I mean, it's really important to listen to Eddie Conway is because he you know, you're like a Nelson Mandela in a way. Your ability to survive this thing and yet be productive. And tell us, what are these three college degrees that you worked on while you're in that in prison?
Well, I had the GI Bill, and I was so angry. Well, I got out of the military because I looked around. I was a sergeant at the time. I looked around and I seen that there were riots all over America in the black community.
Yeah, there had been one in Baltimore 2 years before that was called a riot, right?
Yeah. And I looked at my uniform and I looked at myself and I said, oh no, this is a mistake. I'm going to Vietnam. I'm making the world safe for democracy. And my mother's not safe in Baltimore. You know, my family's not safe in Baltimore. So I decided to come home. And so when I came home, I kind of had that, like, you know, I don't want anything from the Army. I don't want nothing to do with them. And I kind of walked away from all that, and I
started looking. But you were honorably discharged, you know, right?
Oh yes, I was honorably discharged. In fact, I was like I say, I was a sergeant, and I was on my way to become a higher ranking sergeant and to be in Vietnam. So yeah, I had an honorable discharge and all that, but I discharged myself, so to speak, and then I didn't take advantage of the GI bills. And so I got in prison, and guys were taking advantage of it. And I was like, nope, not going to do it. You know, not messing with this, you know. And so I actually waited too late. And I missed, it was like a 10-year kind of time you have to use your GI bill. And I didn't use it. And then it dawned on me that, well, if I'm organizing in here and I'm working in here, I really do need to know how the systems work and so on. And so then I went to school, but they had the Pell Grant at the time, so I was fortunate. So I went to school on the Pell Grant and got an associate's degree. And then I went back to school again on the Pell Grant and got a bachelor's degree. And then I went eventually enrolled in a master's program in the University of California. And I did all the due diligence. I did all the work. I passed all the courses, et cetera. And then they start shipping me around to these rural places that we were talking about, Cumberland, Hagerstown. I didn't go to the Eastern Shore. And they took all my research, and they kind of put me in a real awkward position, and I end up not fighting them, but we had a really rough time. So I never got my master's degree. So I turned it into a book, in fact, and it's one of the books I've written called The Greatest Threat. But that was my research, and that was my work. And the prison administration eventually sent word to me that they would not allow any prisoner to get a master's degree because that was the criteria for a warden. And they wasn't going to have anybody in the prison system that had compatible education to a warden, which was insane.
They put that in writing or something?
No, they sent a major, it was almost like a clandestine spy meeting. They sent the major to meet with me in a secluded hallway and to tell me that. And they took my computer because I had a computer. They took my computer and shipped it out, and they took all my materials. And then they wanted me to come and ask for the materials back. And I'll take responsibility for this. I just simply refused to do it, and it caused me that piece of paper. But I basically told them, like, look, you came, you took my stuff, you know, you did all this stuff. I'm not coming with my hat in my hand and asking you for it back. If you want me to have my stuff back, you bring it back. Eventually, they brought it back, but it was too late for me. But this is the kind of stuff, it's subtle stuff that they do. And like I say, it was almost like I had a clandestine meeting. This was like the good major. So it was like, hey, Conway, come here. Let me talk to you a minute, you know. And it's like, I'm doing you a favor, and here's what's going on, you know. But it was really like, you know, you're going too far, you're out of order, step back or something, or you get shipped somewhere else, you know. So anyway, that's the story.
Well, that's an important story because we're not talking about the Deep South and the bad old days. They're still pretty bad. We're talking about Baltimore. We're talking about a center supposedly of enlightenment, one of the original centers of enlightenment for the American Revolution. We're talking about a state that is often thought of as deep blue or liberal or what have you. And it's interesting because another podcast that I've done with someone who served a long time is Gary Tyler. I don't know if you know his work, but he was originally arrested in a civil rights disturbance and put on death row when he was still a minor. And the U.S. Supreme Court said you can't kill him because he's a minor. And he was in Angola prison in Louisiana. People can look up that podcast. But he's another person who survived and ran the prison theater program and everything and finally got out after a similarly lengthy four-decade sentence. And again, he has that message of survival. Gary Tyler, he now works with young kids in trouble in Los Angeles. But the message is they don't want all these prison programs. They don't want you to succeed. They want to break you. That's really the message we've given up. I think it's an important point. I know I'm taking you got another 10 minutes or so?
Oh, yeah. I'm good.
Okay. So I'd like to stretch this a little bit because the real thing you're exposing here is we're not reinterested in rehabilitation. That's the real problem. And you got conservatives even who've served some time, like going back to the Nixon administration, who come out and suddenly they're judicial reformers. Because even for white privileged people, when they get in there, no one cares about rehabilitation. You know, it's an industry. We want to exploit these people. We want to break them. And we want them to be out of sight so the regular public doesn't get upset because there's been a riot or disturbance in the prison. And again, I bring up this Nelson Mandela comparison because I was always amazed at Nelson Mandela's story in South Africa, that he could come out of that prison such an incredible leader, such a full human being. And that's the way I've felt about you ever since I first met you in person. I feel that way about Gary Tyler. I feel that way about Kevin Cooper, and I was still on death row at San Quentin. How is the human spirit so resilient? How did you do it? You know, and tell us about the good folks of Baltimore and Maryland. You're talking about a prison industrial complex, not in Louisiana or Alabama. You're talking about in a place that a lot of people listening to this probably think is pretty enlightened.
Yeah, and I think one consciousness and consciousness is a really deciding factor. If you know, I was thinking when you were saying you learned more in the post office than you did the 4 years that you
Well, that was before we came on. So let me mention that what we do have in common, I worked in the post office. I don't know, I can't remember now, but it was like 3-4 years. That was my college experience while I went to City College. And Eddie Conway obviously worked in the post office. And we were just chatting before we went on to do this recording about our being clerks in the post office boxing up mail. So, okay.
Yeah, and I was thinking when you said that, experience is the best teacher. You learned life in the post office. Then you went to college.
I went to college, what I said was I learned more in the 42nd Street Post Office in Manhattan. I loved City College up in Harlem, but I learned more in the post office than I did in my college classes. That was for sure.
Yes.
Certainly about racial tension in America, yes.
Yes, and that's consciousness. And it's consciousness, I think, that allows you, once you know who you are, once you know what you're looking at, once you understand, I mean, we don't fully know anything, but once you have an understanding that, okay, this is what's going on here, and this is what's going on there, and this is a problem, and that's a solution. Once you get that consciousness, nothing can actually take it away from you. You can only build on it, and as you build on it, it strengthens your spirit. It strengthens your determination, and that's something that you can't take from a. You can break a person's spirit, but you can't take their consciousness away. Even when you break their spirit, they know what they know. They might decide not to resist anymore. Or they might decide to go along with the program, but they still know what they know. And I think that's an important factor in understanding the world that you live in and understanding your role in it. So many prisoners blame themselves. It's like blaming the victim. It's like, well, I committed the crime. But they don't see the crime that's been committed by redlining. They don't see the crime that's been committed by exploiting. They don't see the crime that's been committed by creating laws that's applicable only to them. They don't see the crime committed by a broken window occupation of their community. They don't see the crime committed by secondhand books in schools, and et cetera. But they see what they did and they blame themselves, and that breaks their spirit because they think they're responsible for the things that happen to them. Until, like I pointed out earlier, until they get the Cumberland or Hagerstown or Eastern Shore, and then some additional stuff happened to them, and then they say, oh no, this is more than I should receive. But until that point, they accept that it's their fault, that the system worked and they just haven't figured it out. When in reality, the system do work, but they haven't figured it out. But it was never designed to work for them. It was always designed to make certain elements wealthy and to promote a white supremacy. It was always designed to extract labor from blacks, whites, browns, reds, yellows, etc., and to keep us at each other's throat, because that's the only way you can exploit, divide, and conquer. And it goes all the way back to Caesar.
Tell us about Caesar.
Well, Caesar did the thing, the bread and circus. I mean, we're still visiting Rome now and looking at the Colosseum. But that was one of the greatest experiments of all time. Give them bread and give them circuses. And the gladiators we saw yesterday in the Colosseums fighting the lions or fighting each other are the gladiators we see today in the stadiums fighting each other with football uniforms on or soccer outfits on or baseball uniforms on. It's just the move 2,000 years into the future, and it's still give them bread and give them circuses and divide them by having them support this team against that team, etc. And it creates a sense of this is my group, this is my piece, and everybody else is outliners, outsiders. And that goes into the work. I was just looking at Amazon workers tried to organize a union. Obviously, Amazon has no reason to resist a union of workers when Amazon is like robbing the whole entire planet. You know, I mean, they have the locks on the whole entire planet, and they begrudge the workers protection down on the ground, and they use that wealth to stop those kind of organizing efforts that's beneficial to people down on the ground. Instead of saying, we can share this wealth, we're still taking 90%, but you can have 10%. No, they want to take 99% and you can only have 1%. And, you know, so that's divide and conquer. And they're constantly doing that. And it's the way in which the ruling class gets wealthy and get into space. I keep pointing that out because it's a tremendous new exploitation of resources in the solar system getting ready to jump off. And we're right here at the edge of it. And it's happening because of the wealth they're stealing from prisoners and workers.
And interestingly enough, you know, look, I'm going to push this a little further. You'll probably have to hang up on me. And one reason I do these podcasts, I think the main reason, I'm certainly not getting paid for it. I do it for two reasons. One is I learn so much. I mean, I'm still going to school, and I'm 10 years older than you, Eddie. I'm 85. And, you know, I do it because I'm learning. I've learned more from this podcast than, you know, anything else I did for the last couple of months. And maybe some other podcasts, but I do that. But also, I'm trying to get a textbook that can be used. I still teach at the University of Southern California. I just feel so many of our textbooks really are dry in the field of communication, journalism, which hardly really exists anymore. And so I see that. And it's interesting. You mentioned the Colosseum and we have the Colosseum at USC, the famous sports arena in LA, and the great distraction of even college football. And another distraction that we have at the universities days, and we certainly have it at USC, which is an institution I happen to respect a great deal, and particularly for its location in the inner city of Los Angeles, but we have this daily drumbeat of police reports that the state legislature somehow required be shared with us. And it's invariably, you know, a 5'10" Latino male or a 6'1" 6'0" black male, and they're arrested for stealing iPhones or, you know, robbing some car and more serious stuff. And you have this racial dichotomy, this class dichotomy, and people rarely ask the question, what is all this policing and arrest? Where does it lead? And today in this podcast, I got really a sense what it leads is to more violence in the prisons, that we don't do rehabilitation. So let's just take the last few minutes. You've been out since 2014. That's not a long time. But what have you seen on the outside? What have you seen about our society? Let's wrap this up with Eddie Conway's view of the free world now. And I want to put one little footnote, by the way, something you just said about Amazon that relates to this. This is a worldwide problem. If you take Amazon, most of the stuff that they've been selling us is made in China or other countries, but China disproportionately. And we ask very few questions about the workforce in these countries. Are they in prison? Do they have the right to form a union? Are they free people that are supplying, including the very computer that I'm talking on, the sound system, but everything else practically, the clothes we wear and so forth. So this question of imprisonment, freedom, the rights of individuals is worldwide. And I want to ask you, what have you seen in the last 6 years that you've been out about this free world? And we'll conclude on that, but take your time.
Okay, well, one of the things was that, and I think all prisoners, especially prisoners that do over 10 years or so, they dream about getting out of prison and going on the beach and relaxing and enjoying their life. And so after 40 plus years, I had that same aspiration. And when I got out, and I traveled up and down the main streets of Baltimore, and I looked at the houses, I looked at the conditions, and I was in a state of shock. I thought it looked like Baltimore had been in a war, like the 40-some years that I was missing, that there had been a war. And in fact, the conditions were so bad that I said, well, I can't go to the beach. I need to go in back into the community and try to organize and at least give young people an opportunity, a chance not to get caught up into this stuff. So Baltimore looked like a third world country. America, in fact, looks like a third world country, with the exception of the gentrification of the financial class and the professional class. Most of America now, and I was sitting on my steps, or on my porch, in fact, and I saw this old guy come. He could have been a professor. I don't know who he was, but he was doing DoorDash. He was delivering food for somebody that was trying to eat. And as I sat out there and I watched, and I realized that conditions are so bad in America that even senior citizens that should be cared for by society, it's got to be out picking up hot dogs and sodas and taking them to somebody. America has fallen into a bad place, and that's part of why you see that January the 6th attempted coup that occurred in D.C. is because the people that are involved in that kind of stuff are doing just as bad, but they need to blame it on somebody. They need an excuse. So the excuse is the other people, those people. They're the fault. They're the responsibility. They don't know how to work. They don't know how to organize. But the fact of the matter is the society has been organized in such a way that they're going to be exploited no matter what. But then psychologically, they have to find a justification for why they're doing bad, why there's more rural white people on welfare than there are black people on welfare. Yeah, they don't want to even hear those statistics. They don't want to hear the statistics about why the mountaintop removal is detrimental to all the citizens in their community and they're getting black and brown lung. They don't want to hear that because we got to work somewhere, you know. So the America has actually, and we're looking at Afghanistan now, and the only reason we don't see people flying out of there hanging off the rails of helicopters is because they got the word and decided to get out. And they're leaving 1 million people in there in jeopardy, probably. But that's because that military might doesn't work anymore, that a hegemonity don't work anymore, the world is too polarized now in different camps and so on. And America is seeing the sunset, and it's a problem. And it's a problem for white supremacy, and it's certainly not a problem for the ruling class because they have no loyalty to any flags or any nation. They'll leave America and go to France. They'll go to Haiti if necessary, or they'll set up their own island. Probably in the near future, there'll be a moon base, you know. So it's not a problem for them, but it's a problem down on the ground. And down on the ground, we are 10 years maybe from the planet not sustaining breathable air. And of course, you know, you got your California fires, you got your Greece fires, you got climate change, you got stuff falling apart all over the planet, and it's largely because of exploitation and misuse of resources. So what I see is young people have a big responsibility. They're gonna have, and older people too. And you're doing your share at 85. I'm doing mine at 75. But we all have a role, but we can't run as fast as young people anymore. So we are walking to it now, but they need to be running to this because it's a serious crisis and we're at the doorsteps of it. And we are going to probably see Hitler or Trump or whoever, Pence or whatever, in the next couple of years again. And we're going to have to look at that. And we're going to have to figure out how to deal with that. Because this, it's not going to go away. That's my final word.
It's not going to go away. Those are the words of Eddie Conway. And I'm stunned here because, like you said, when people want to get out of prison, they think they'll go to the beach and try to get something. I didn't spend any time in prison, you know. And you know, I complain, I should be giving up this stuff. And most of my colleagues and friends, you know, well, when can I retire and get this? Here's a guy, and I got it wrong before. I said he did almost 45 years. He served 43 years and 11 months. He only got out of prison in March 4th, 2014. You know, I've been complaining, why am I doing this and we're doing that? Here's Eddie Conway, comes out, and he has been working nonstop, and I want to really give a big shout out. First of all, his show is called Rattling the Bars. People got to go to it. I'm making a commitment right now. If they'll give me permission on my website, I'm going to run Rattling the Bars every single episode. That's how much respect I've gained for Eddie Conway's work as a journalist. Now, I think people have got to check that out. Check out the Real News network. You know, we all, those of us who do journalism, we think what we do is so wonderful. And, you know, well, I'll say right here and now, yeah, I've been active as a journalist, but an organization like the Real News Network, there are others out there. The Nation is one that I respect because it's the oldest continuing publishing political journal. And there are others doing really good work. But check out the Real News Network. It's just, you know, centered in Baltimore. It says the news in Baltimore is of worldwide significance. They also cover Washington and so forth. And check out Eddie Conway. But that, you know, I keep promising to end this. And this is the moment in which I'm going to do that. Thank you, Eddie Conway. And hopefully we'll have you back to comment more on as the situation evolves. And I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW FM station, the NPR station in Santa Monica, that runs these shows, posts them, and Christopher Ho gets them up there in good quality. I want to thank Natasha Hakimi Zapata for doing the introductions, Lucy Berbio for doing this transcription, Joshua Shear, who set this thing up and said, you got to talk to Eddie Conway about this. Joshua Shear is our executive producer. And I want to thank the JWK Foundation, which in memory of a great journalist, Gene Stein, helps support these shows. See you next week with another edition of Shear.
Hey, Bob, let me just say thanks for having me. And I'm always happy to come on your show. So anytime or any topic that you want to discuss or we can converse about, feel free to get in touch.
Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, school is starting again at USC, and I'd love to have you come in just the beginning of September and talk to my class by Zoom or whatever.
I would love to do that.
Okay.
I would
and
love
anybody
to do
else
that.
Listening to this who happens to be teaching in a high school or college, take advantage of the wisdom of Eddie Conway. See you next week with another edition of Shear Intelligence.